Hey, Dan here. Before we start the show, I want to tell you about a live recording of this podcast that we're doing in New York City on March 28th. I will be interviewing two frequent flyers from this show, the legendary meditation teacher, Joseph Goldstein, who will be just coming off a three-month solo silent meditation retreat, and Dr. Mark Epstein, a Buddhist therapist and best-selling author. The event will actually be a celebration of the 10th anniversary of my first book, 10% Happier, and a percentage of the proceeds will go to the New York Insight Meditation Center. Come early if you want for a VIP guided meditation and Q&A with me. Thanks to our friends over at Audible for sponsoring this show and the event. Tickets on sale right now at symphonyspace.org. This is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Okay, kids, before we get to today's guest, I'm going to tell you a story. Way back when, in like 2008 or 9, right when I was starting to get interested in personal growth or spirituality or whatever you want to call it, I happened to meet a guy named Deepak Chopra. You've probably heard of him. He's a medical doctor, best-selling author, one of the biggest names in the self-help world, also very controversial, about which more in a moment. Anyway, I ended up hanging out with him a little bit. I did some stories on him, and then I wrote about him extensively in my first book, which is called 10% Happier, after which this show is named. In the book, I talked about how fascinating Deepak was to me as somebody who was at the beginning of his interest in mindfulness, etc. But I also made fun of him a little bit, calling out his penchant for using grandiose phrases such as transformational vortex to the infinite. Those are actual words he uttered to me. I still don't know what they mean. I also wrote about a moment that happened at a debate that I was moderating on television in 2010, where Deepak faced off with a scientist who was critical of Deepak's use of scientific concepts. I should say many scientists are critical of Deepak in this regard. He's been accused of twisting ideas like quantum physics. Anyway, here's a little clip.
What is it about Deepak's use of quantum physics that bothers you?
The term non-local, the use was not correct, and the correlations of, the pacemaker and the different electrical things going on.
I happen to disagree, by the way.
Oh, I assume
even
you did, since you said that.
I'd love to talk about it. I think consciousness is non-local.
I'm sorry?
I think consciousness is non-local.
Consciousness.
Oh. Is non-local.
I've never really run across a definition of consciousness that I understood. So maybe you could teach me something, and I can.
A field, a superposition of possibilities.
Okay, well, all right, I know what all each of those words means. I still don't think I know.
That was quite a moment, kind of went viral. Anyway, back to the story. As it happened, in the 10 years since my first book, 10% Happier, came out, I had not actually spoken to Deepak at all. So I didn't actually know if he was pissed at me or if he even read the book or even heard about it. Meanwhile, I also had not really kept up much with his books or his ideas during that time, so I wanted to have him on to find out, would I be more open to his ideas and to him now? Hence, today's interview. As you may know, we're doing a special series for much of this month, during which we're celebrating the 10th anniversary of 10% Happier. Quick plug, I just put out a revised 10th anniversary edition. If you want to buy it, there's a link in the show notes. As part of this series, I'm going back and interviewing many of the main players in the book, and you're about to hear my first encounter with Deepak Chopra since the book came out. Just to say, Deepak has a new book out himself. It's called Quantum Body, The New Science of Living a Longer, Healthier, More Vital Life. His main argument about the quantum field is that it is fundamentally interconnected with our consciousness and our bodily processes, and you're going to hear me press him on that. But we also quickly move into areas that are much easier to understand and to relate to, such as how Deepak handles criticism, how he regulates his own stress, and how he feels about death. Deepak Chopra, coming up. But first, time for some BSP, blatant self-promotion. There are still, I believe, a few more tickets available for the meditation party retreat that I'm doing with Sebane Selassie and Jeff Warren at the Omega Institute, which is outside of New York City. We'll be doing a weekend filled with meditation and conversation. There's even a dance party. If you can't make the event coming up in May, we've got another one coming up in October. Meanwhile, I also want to point out that May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and as we all know, meditation is a great way to improve your mental health, which is why I co-founded the 10% Happier Meditation app. I highly recommend it. You can start with a course that teaches you the basics and then build from there. Download the app for free wherever you find your apps. This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. I got to tell you, I feel so much better when I talk about my anxiety instead of keeping it bottled up. There's an expression that I first heard from the great researcher and also Zen practitioner Robert Waldinger: never worry alone. Our temptation many times is to keep it bottled up, but the data really show that the people who do the best in life, who live the longest and are the happiest, have strong relationships with people with whom they can talk about whatever's going on in their lives. And for me, therapy is part of that. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happier today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/happier. Audible lets you enjoy all your audio entertainment in one app. You will always find the best of what you love or something new to discover. They offer an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers and new releases to celebrity memoirs, mysteries and thrillers, motivation, wellness, business, and more. What I've been checking out recently is called Our Share of Night. It's technically, I guess, a horror, but it's definitely literature. I mean, it's incredibly well written, absolutely fascinating. And it really does rhyme with some of the themes that we explore on this show. I highly recommend it, although I'm only through the first 15-20% of it, but already I highly recommend it. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/10%. Or text 10% to 500-500. That's audible.com/10%. Or text 10% to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. audible.com/10%. Deepak Chopra, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan.
Congratulations on your latest book, number 94. That's mind-boggling to me as somebody who's only on book number 3. But congratulations.
Thank you.
So can you describe what the thesis is of your latest book?
The thesis of the latest book is that beyond what we call body-mind is a field of awareness that correlates everything with everything else. That when we get to this ground state of our experience, there's perfect homeostasis. So in the last 35 years, there's been a lot of research on epigenetics and also on meditation. And in the year 2012, we did a study at our center that included scientists from Harvard, included the Nobel laureate Elizabeth Blackburn from UCSF, Mount Sinai, Duke University, where after a one-week meditation retreat, we looked at gene activity. And in 1 week, all the genes that were responsible for self-regulation or homeostasis, which is, you know, the body's fundamental state of balance, the dynamic non-change in the midst of change, blood sugar has to remain with a certain level, body temperature, insulin levels, endocrine hormones, all the genes that were responsible for self-regulation went up some 17-fold. All the genes that were responsible for inflammation and also associated with chronic illness like Alzheimer's, heart disease, chronic, you know, things like coronary artery disease, autoimmune illness, wound healing, they went down. The genes that were causing distress went down. The genes that were causing in one word, healing or self-regulation went up. So this was astonishing. Now, since then, many, many studies have replicated these studies that mindfulness, meditation, self-inquiry, self-reflection, vagal stimulation, all these things actually change gene activity. They bring down inflammation. They change the genes that are responsible for disease. They decrease the activity of the genes that are responsible for disease, increase the activity of the genes that are responsible for self-regulation. Many, now it's accepted. I mean, if you go Google this or AI this, there's no question. If you ask Google Bard or ChatGPT, does meditation change gene expression? Answer is yes. Do our thoughts, do our feelings, do our emotions, do our imagination change gene expression? The answer is yes. So basis of this book is that if you get to the ground state of experience, if you get, you know, thoughts, feelings, sensations, images, and the mind goes into almost stillness or close to stillness, then self-regulation kicks in. So the book describes various modalities that are now accepted.
This is going to be the first of many times where the limits of my scientific understanding will become very obvious. So I apologize in advance for that.
That's okay.
So help me understand something. As I understand it, many of the things you just said are uncontroversial, that meditation can have a deep impact on our physiology. However, the book is saying something that goes a little bit further, if I understand it correctly, which is that through our minds, we can impact the quantum level of our body, meaning the subatomic level of the makeup of our body, the spinning particles that exist below the level of the atom. Is there a difference between those two things?
Not mind, Dan. If you want to use a word, you should use consciousness. So mind is an activity in consciousness, a modified activity in consciousness. Consciousness is the ground state of experience. When the consciousness fluctuates, then it produces what we call qualia. Qualia means units of qualities of experience. The color red, the taste of wine, the smell of garlic. These are commonly cited examples of qualia. So qualia is a unit of experience. Quanta, on the other hand, is an energetic fluctuation of the quantum field. So if you ask again, you know, these is easy to do research because of AI and things. Are qualia and quanta complementarities? Do they correspond to each other? You'll get different views. If you go again on the internet and explore, is the quantum field subjective? The answer will be usually no. Then you ask, is it self-regulating? The answer is yes. Then you say, you know, it depends on the prompt. If it's self-regulating, can it be self-aware? The answer is number of people think so. Is there such a thing called quantum consciousness? A minority of quantum scientists believe there is. So, of course, every time I say something, it's controversial. I'm known for that. But, you know, 35 years ago when I wrote Quantum Healing, it was totally ridiculed, and there was no epigenetics. And when epigenetics came out as a science 20 years ago, my good old friend Richard Dawkins said, it's the fad of the day. He's quoted up that. Now, you know, epigenetics is totally accepted that every experience, including the experience you and I are having right now, is triggering gene activity in your frontal cortex. If this was an emotional conversation, you would see gene activity in the limbic system. If you were threatened in a terrorist attack, you would see gene activity in the reptilian brain. So it turns out that at a very fundamental level, gene activity is regulated by the fluctuations of consciousness that we call sensations, sense perceptions, images, feelings, and thoughts. The thoughts are only one aspect of the total gamut of experience.
So is the takeaway from the book that if we do the right kind of meditation, it will be good for us? Is that the, I'm putting in reductive terms, but is that roughly correct?
I think that's oversimplistic. If you look at the last, let's say during COVID or before COVID, slightly before COVID, but in the last decade, the major breakthroughs in biology are, number one, AI, because you can monitor biological parameters through AI and give feedback. For example, I did a project with Fitbit recently where people were able to look at their heart rate variability and change it in real time through breathing and other meditative practices. So AI is a very big innovation. The second innovation is gene editing. 5% of our genes are totally, fully penetrant for disease. So if somebody has a BRCA gene, like say Angelina Jolie had, that predicts disease no matter what. Now, soon we have gene editing for that. You'll be able to cut and paste genes the way you cut and paste emails. The third major breakthrough in science is what we call messenger RNA, which came along when COVID came and, you know, the vaccine that was developed through messenger RNA. But now we're going to have messenger RNA techniques of vaccines for cancer, et cetera, soon. I was speaking to the CEO of Moderna and he said, we'll have vaccines for just about every chronic disease in the future because of messenger RNA. So that's the third big breakthrough. The fourth is the microbiome, which is 2 million extra genes you have in addition to the 25,000 genes that you have that your parents gave. So you only have 25,000 human genes. You have 2 million microbial genes. You can change that through diet and through meditation. That's the fourth major breakthrough. The fifth is psychedelics. And the sixth is vagal activation, which is the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the longest nerve in our body, which now it turns out is the healing nerve. And you can activate it through many techniques, including yoga, breathing exercises, mind-body coordination, changing your diet, exercises of various kinds. So we are entering an era where people will roll up their eyes, but we are entering an era where with everything we know from reductionist science and then the holistic innovations that are now being actually documented through technology, technology has been a great boon to be able to measure experience. Until now, we could not measure experience. If you said, I'm feeling compassion or love, there was no way to measure what was happening to vagal activity or to inflammatory markers in the body. But now that we can measure everything, I think in the next decade, you'll see that people will have longer health spans. Chronic disease might become optional. And we are seeing a new era in well-being. So my book is not just about meditation. It's about everything that we are now, you know, seeing in the field of biological science.
Again, this is another point where my lack of scientific expertise is going to become very obvious. So I apologize. But is it possible that one could hear those six, I believe, breakthroughs that you just described and say, okay, yeah, those all sound legit, but I don't need to believe in manipulation of the quantum field in order to believe in any of, and in fact, in practice, many of those exercises that you described?
You don't need to, but you could also do your own research. You could go to, you know, ChatGPT and say, does the quantum field influence gene activity? And then you don't believe me. Look at what the consensus is. And you'll find lots of opinions, including the opinions I expressed in the book.
So back in the day, when you first came out with this argument that the quantum field, again, our subatomic particle layer of...
Let's define the quantum field.
Please.
I mean, can you define the quantum field for me or should I define it for you?
The odds of me being able to define it are low, but I think it's just basically the particles that exist below the level of the atom, right?
The quantum field is a mathematical structure that defines the likelihood of particles popping in and out of the field as determined by something called the uncertainty principle. So that's the quantum field. And every moment, the quantum field is, of course, pervades all of space-time, including your body. Okay, you can't get out of the quantum field. And is the quantum field subjective or objective? That is the controversy. But if you go a little deeper, you can't have an object without a subject, and you can't have a subject without the object. They're entangled as an experience. So is the quantum field influencing our biology? And the answer is yes. You can look it up. Is it influencing genetic activity? The answer is yes. Look it up. Don't believe me.
But can we influence it? Can I influence the quantum level of my own body?
No, you don't influence it. You actually immerse yourself in the ground of all experience, which is what meditation does. See, meditation in the West has become only a recent phenomenon. But in Eastern wisdom traditions, meditation was for what was called self-realization, which is going beyond your identity as a body-mind to the source of the body-mind, to the source of all experience. That was the original, you know, these guys sitting in caves meditating, monks, they weren't doing it for stress management. They were trying to understand what is fundamental reality. And if you read the descriptions of self-realization in Vedanta and Kashmir Shaivism, in fact, actually, this morning, I checked out Erwin Schrödinger, who described the wave function, which describes everything in the universe. Other than Einstein's E is equal to mc squared, I think Schrödinger's wave function is the most important equation in the world. So I went into AI. I said, did Schrödinger believe that the fundamental reality of the universe was awareness? And the answer I got, if you want, I'll read it out to you. It's very fascinating. May I, actually?
Sure, of course.
Here's what I asked AI. I said, was Schrödinger a student of Vedanta and consciousness traditions? Erwin Schrödinger was a student of Vedanta and found its ideas to be consistent with the findings of quantum mechanics. Schrödinger wrote, quote unquote, "The very essence of our being is not in an undetermined state, but rather the eternal self, at least until consciousness is extinguished. Consciousness is not produced by the brain, but rather appears because we are looking inward with our attention, like light shining on itself." He wrote, "I can see only one escape from the confines of materialism. The world as we see it is a creation of consciousness." Schrödinger's ideas were controversial in his time, but they have become increasingly influential in recent years. Many physicists and philosophers believe that the findings of quantum mechanics are consistent with the ideas of non-materialist philosophies. So I'm reading you directly what I got from Google Bard.
Really interesting. So I guess you're using that to point to the fact that you're not as far out on a limb as others accuse you of being?
I don't care now. You know, I'm 77. In my tradition, the first 25 years is you study. You're a student. Second 25 years, fame and fortune. So I can say, been there, done that. Third 25 years is giving back. Been there, done that. I just entered my fourth quarter, which is preparation for death and self-realization. So at this point, I don't care what people think.
I've been in the room when you've been harshly criticized, and you didn't seem to like it in the moment, but it seems like you...
Yeah. You know, it takes a while to go over that. You know, you remember you in the intermission with that debate that I had with Michael Shermer and Sam Harris. Leonard Mlodinow got up and he said, "I'm a co-author of Stephen Hawking, and what you're saying is full of nonsense." So that made the headlines. It lived on the internet, still is there. I wrote to Leonard after that. I said, "You know, you understand quantum physics, but you don't understand consciousness. Come and meet me in New York. You teach me physics and I'll teach you consciousness." So we became best friends. We wrote a book together called War of the Worldviews, which became a New York Times bestseller. So that was very fortuitous for me, that debate.
And so you feel like in the years since the debate, you've done a very hard thing, which is gotten increasingly comfortable with being criticized, with being called a fraud, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I have. My next chapter is death. I mean, what's the big deal? You know, when you look behind in my life, I've had a very fruitful life. I've had a successful life. I've been vilified, but I've also, my critics have kept me in circulation, you know. So in a sense, I'm grateful to them. They've kept the conversation going. Last week, by the way, I was speaking about these matters at the Oxford Union in Oxford, and the reception was very warm. Not that everybody agreed, but it was very warm. But, you know, Dan, it doesn't matter anymore. You know, when you're 78 and you're looking at death as you, and by the way, I'm in really good health, so I can't say that I'm sick, but I do realize this is my final chapter.
Coming up, Deepak Chopra talks about the concept of creative intelligence. He talks about breathing techniques, including vagal breathing and box breathing. And he talks about the benefits of imagining your own death. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected after investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns. T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile, third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans. The good folks from Tidy Care Alert sent us some kitty litter in the mail. That's not normally the kind of thing you want to get in the mail, but when you have four cats, it's actually a very exciting development. So we've been using Tidy Care Alert, and our cats seem to be very happy. They're pooping away very happily. Tidy Care Alert has long-lasting ammonia control, so your house won't smell like you have cats. It's low dust and lightweight, and it's from the brand most often recommended and personally used by veterinarians. Tidy Care Alert uses color-changing crystals to detect potential concerns and help you put your mind at ease. Let Tidy Care Alert help keep an eye on your cat's health. Whether you have one cat or you're a crazy person like me and my wife and our son, and you have four cats, they make it easy to track. Tidy Care Alert. It's Mental Health Awareness Month, and while meditation is good for your mental health, it can also be challenging. The 10% Happier app makes starting meditation easy. Download the app for free wherever you get your apps. Could I read your book, do the exercises you suggest, and derive benefit from them, whether I agree with or even understand your argument about the quantum field?
I think so. But being who I am, I can't resist invoking. I am obsessively compulsive, but this has occupied three decades of my life. So, you know, I'm in a way, it's probably my ego that says, gosh, I wish these guys, academics, would come around to looking at subjectivity as well. Because you see, even to do science, you need consciousness. You can't do science without consciousness. Theories are conceived in consciousness. Experiments are designed in consciousness. Observations are made in consciousness. So, you know, this is a word, consciousness. And then people argue about what is it. And there's a very simple definition of consciousness, which is, it is what makes experience happen, period. Without consciousness, there's no experience. And then if you replace the word object, look at me for a moment. So if I asked you this, what's this? You'd say it's a phone. Okay, that's an object. But before I can call it an object, it is an experience. And what's the experience? Sensation, sense perception, smell, taste, sound. First, I have to have the experience. Then I insert the human construct. It's an object, and that it's an iPhone. So, you know, you cannot call an object unless you experience it in consciousness first. And then you can go all the way. But, you know, that's not how scientists work. science itself, I think, needs an upgrade, as does spirituality, because, you know, our ideas about God, this, that, the other, pretty outmoded, you know. So spirituality should be understood as self-awareness and period, nothing more than that.
So you have some confidence that science will catch up to your ideas, whether you're alive to see it or not?
I do. In fact, you know, if you want, I'll send you, and I don't have to, but if you want, I'll send you on my YouTube channel conversations that I've had with Nobel Prize winning quantum physicists, who some of them dance around the edge, some of them say nonsense, and some of them say, you know, you might be right.
Okay, so let's talk about the other aspect of the book, which I was hinting at before in some of my earlier questions, which is some exercises that you recommend, meditation exercises that, in my opinion, don't rest on whether I can grok or agree with the whole quantum debate. You use the term creative intelligence. Can you define that before we dive into some of the specific exercises you recommend?
Creative intelligence is the idea that awareness modifies itself in an organized manner where our experience of life is unified. So you're experiencing sense perceptions right now. So, you know, it takes a fraction of a second for light to enter your eyes. We don't know how that produces the physical experience of the universe, form and structure, but it takes a little bit of time for light to enter your eyes. For sound to enter your brain, it takes some other measurement. This is called the binding problem. How do disparate activities all come together as a unified whole? And some people invoke the idea that creative intelligence is what takes the unmanifest, which is totally irreducible, formless, spaceless, timeless, incomprehensible, unimaginable, fundamental. That, how does it turn into mind, intellect, ego, physical body, and experience of the physical universe as a unified experience? I know that the term is unfortunate because then it invokes creationism and all of that. But creative intelligence is a term used in biology. And again, you can check it out on AI.
And you list in the book some techniques for enhancing our creative intelligence. They include breathing, feeling, and seeing. I'd love to dive into these techniques and these exercises and get you to walk us through them. You up for that?
Yeah.
So the first one is breathing, and I think it has to do with vagal breathing. What can you describe what vagal breathing is and how we do it?
Yeah, I actually simplified vagal breathing in the book. It says box breathing. So you basically, you breathe into the count of 4 or 6, however comfortable you are, and then you breathe out to the, and always through the nose. And that stimulates the vagus nerve, which is the anti-inflammatory nerve, which reduces inflammation in the body. But that, what I introduced in the book, is very basic. I personally practice vagal breathing, where I breathe in to the count of 6, breathe out to the count of 12, hold to the count of 12, and then breathe in again 6. That gives me 2 breaths a minute. And when I breathe 2 breaths a minute, my brain waves go down to less than 4 hertz, which is the state of deep sleep. So I could be talking to you, but my brain waves would be deep sleep. But I didn't introduce that in the book because it would be very strenuous for people to do that. But, you know, just breathing in through the nose to the count of 6, and breathing out through the nose to the count of 6, you will start to stimulate the vagus nerve, and you can measure that. And you can actually, the best way to measure that is through heart rate variability. So if you have an iWatch, you can actually look at your heart rate variability while you're doing the vagal breathing, and you'll see it increases. So the more variable your heart rate is, the more relaxed you are. The more fixed it is, there's like an army going to war. That's sympathetic overdrive. So that's vagal breathing.
So let me just repeat it back to you, make sure I got it. Vagal breathing, in the way you describe it in the book, and there are variations, is breathing through the nose to the count of 6 and breathing out to the count of 6. How long would one do that?
A few minutes. You'll see actually the effects on heart rate variability within a couple of minutes.
Before I meditate, I often will do straw breathing, deep breath in through the nose, and then a much longer out breath through the mouth, but as if you're blowing through a straw. I have found it doing that at the beginning of my meditation for a couple of minutes, and I don't time it. But I have found that I don't know what physiological effects it's having, but it feels really good. And
well, you can't feel good without a physiological effect.
Well, you can, yes, but you can have an unhealthy, I could take some sort of pill that would make me feel good, but might not be good for me.
Yeah, you could take alcohol or something like that. Yeah.
So this vagal breathing is a very healthy thing, you're arguing. And then you would also argue, going through the list here from breathing to feeling to seeing, that the feeling exercise you recommend is a body scan. Can you describe that?
Okay, so if you close your eyes right now and you just actually start with feeling the sensations in your body from the inside out, that's the simplest thing. Now, the fact that you can feel sensations from the inside out, that's actually a Buddhist meditation. Instead of watching your breath, you watch the sensations. But in order to feel the sensations from the inside out, your awareness must be inside your body. Okay? Now, if you look at your body from the outside, then your awareness has to be outside your body. If you close your eyes right now, and let me try this. Let's try this. Close your eyes. And imagine snow-clad mountains. Now imagine a rainbow. Now imagine a beautiful red rose. Now imagine that you're singing, listening to John Lennon singing Imagine, and hear the sound. Imagine that you're tasting a strawberry. Imagine that you're licking a lemon. Okay, open your eyes. So where's your awareness now? It's in something called mental space. In the first instance, it was inside your body. In the second instance, it was outside your body. So your awareness can be inside the body. It can be outside the body. And then if you develop a technique where you actually imagine, which I do, I imagine my death at night, where I imagine, you know, my body being cremated, et cetera, et cetera. But then I can't get rid of the one who's imagining. Mm. So that there are three spaces that awareness occupies: physical space, mental space, and infinite space. And I didn't go into that in the book because it's too esoteric, but that's actually a procedure where you realize awareness has no location in space or time. And that's what spiritual traditions call the spirit. Okay. So you can be in mental space, you can be in physical space, or you can be in infinite space. I simplified the exercises here because, you know, they're too esoteric and people get scared when you tell them to imagine their death and things like that. But I do that practice every day. I prepare for my death by going into this infinite space.
You prepare for your death by imagining dying and what will happen in the aftermath, or?
No. One thing I can't get rid of is the awareness or the consciousness that imagines. You see, when we speak of consciousness, it's not a personal thing. Your mind is personal, but consciousness is infinite. Now, in the old days, they called it God, but, you know, that's a dangerous word these days. But infinite awareness is being accepted by some cognitive scientists, that there's awareness outside of space-time. Where is this experience happening? This experience you and I are happening, where is it happening? You say in the brain, but there's no picture in the brain. You say in the eyes, there's no image of you and me in the eyes. The only place it's happening is in consciousness, and we can't locate consciousness, so it's not in space-time. It doesn't have a form, so it must be infinite.
So to go back to your dying exercise, Deepak lying in bed, imagining death and the cremation process.
Ashes, cremation, everything.
And then the key move is to look for who is what or who is taking in this image.
Yeah. What is it? And it's not a person, because the person is part of the imagination. Awareness is not a person. It's not personal. It's non-local.
We can do this just listening to your voice or my voice. We can ask ourselves, what's hearing this?
Yeah, exactly. And it's an impossible answer. If you look at current cognitive neuroscience, you can't answer that question.
In the Buddhist tradition, we say the not finding is the finding.
That is it.
So when you say I go into infinite space, I think that's what you mean, right?
Yeah, nothingness. But nothingness is not a void. It's the womb of creation. It's organized.
Well, okay, let me dig in on that for a second, because that can sound esoteric and grand, but in my experience, mm-hmm. looking for the looker, just, you know, if I'm hearing Deepak's voice or even hearing my own voice and I try to find what is knowing this, it's right there on the surface. That exercise does not require living in a Himalayan cave.
Yeah.
One can do that with zero experience. And so
correct.
You can put a lot of fancy words on it, but it's actually pretty a grounded experience.
Yeah, it's a grounded experience and you're living in it. You know, there's a joke, two young fish going in one direction and an old fish coming from the other side. And the older fish says to the two young fish, "How's the water, guys? How's the water today?" And then they pass by and then the two young fish say, "What was he speaking about, the water?" You know, you're so engulfed in this that you take it for granted.
Mm-hmm. So back to your exercise of feeling this body scan, you said, you know, just close your eyes and feel your body from the inside, but, you know.
Okay, and that was one, but you can scan your body. You can scan your musculoskeletal system. That's another Buddhist exercise called the wheel of awareness. So imagine a wheel, and the hub of the wheel is awareness, and the rim of the wheel has four quadrants. The first quadrant is the five senses. The second quadrant is the musculoskeletal system and what is happening inside your body. The third quadrant is mental space, and the fourth quadrant is relationship with the universe, relationship with the whole wheel of, and then the wheel itself is awareness. To do it properly, you go through the whole wheel of awareness, of the five senses, the musculoskeletal system, and you're bringing awareness. See, the awareness of an experience is intrinsically free of the experience. It sounds esoteric, but just like the screen on which we're seeing this program is intrinsically free of the programs that come and go. The screen is permanent. So once you identify with the screen and not the programs, then you have this sudden equanimity because you're not caught up with the experience. So, you know, awareness itself is intrinsically free from the experiences in awareness. So the body scan, when done properly, it actually frees you from experience.
Hmm. And it also gives you, as you write in the book, I always mispronounce this word, but I think it's interoception.
Yeah, interoceptive awareness.
Yeah.
So here's this very interesting thing. We all learn interoceptive awareness as babies. You call it toilet training. You can teach interoceptive awareness to your cat or your dog. But the yogis said, why did you stop there? You can do that with your heart. You can do that with your gut. You can do that with your immune system. You can do that with your body temperature. But properly done, interoceptive awareness gives you complete autonomic control of your body. Total.
Is that something that you're capable of?
Yeah. I can reduce my heart rate to less than 50. I'll show you something right now. Put your hands on your lap, open, and close your eyes, and bring your awareness to your heart, and try to the best of your ability to feel your heartbeat. You may or may not be able to, but you'll feel something. Now, when you feel you're ready, move your awareness to your fingertips and feel your heartbeat in your fingertips. And you should be able to feel some throbbing, something, a throbbing or a tingling. Do you feel that?
Yes.
Okay. So that's interoceptive awareness of the heart. Now, when you get good at that, you can slow it down, you can speed it up, then you can actually not only put it in your fingertips, you can actually put it into your entire body. And then your whole body feels like a pulsing field of awareness. So there are many techniques, interoceptive awareness, but you know, you have to be a yogi and you have to be doing this and you have to be a little neurotic like I am.
You're still a little neurotic after all of these years of practice?
About these things, yes.
Okay.
Am I doing it right? you know, if I get to 48, can I get to 46? You know, thanks. I can increase my body temperature and cool it down too.
So what's the benefit of being able to do that, though?
You know that you regulate your autonomic nervous system, and that's ultimately the key to self-regulation, homeostasis.
Self-regulation, homeostasis, meaning optimal health?
Means dynamic non-change within change. So, you know, we are moving around every day. You go outside your apartment, it's really cold, but you have to wear a fur coat or whatever, but you don't need to. You can actually regulate your body temperature. So these are ancient techniques. Interoceptive awareness is a very ancient technique.
Coming up, Deepak talks about the exercise of returning to your zero point and the concept of the body as a verb. The weather is getting warmer. Time to ditch my jackets and sweaters for shorts and tees. I used to waste my money on clothing that would only last one season. That was until I found Quince. Now I've got high-quality pieces that never go out of style that I will be wearing year after year. Quince has all the seasonal must-haves like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. I just made a big order at Quince.com. I got two pairs of sweatpants that I've just had for like a week, and I already love them. I'm wearing them all the time. Sweatpants are a huge deal to me because I work from home and I want to look reasonably good, you know, in front of my wife and stuff, but I want to be comfortable, and the Quince sweatpants do the trick. For me, the bottom line is they've got good looking stuff at low prices. Not a bad recipe. You should go ahead and upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/happier for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/happier to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/happier. It's spring, and that means it's graduation season, and I've got an idea for an incredibly fun graduation gift or party favor. Did you know that you can get personalized M&Ms? You can choose from over 20 colors and add your graduate's name, graduation-themed graphics, or photos, which are printed directly on the candy. I recently got a sample of some of these personalized M&Ms. They showed up in my mailbox. They got my face on them, which makes it a little bit awkward for me to eat them personally. I'm doing it anyway. The M&Ms I got also include the words 10% happier, to which I have a deep attachment. I was kind of thrilled when I saw them. I was wondering if they were a gift from somebody on the 10th anniversary of the 10% Happier book. Turns out they weren't. They were a gift from M&Ms, who are now a sponsor of this show. So thank you, M&Ms, for sponsoring this show and for the delicious treat. You can visit MMS.com to create your own unique custom gifts and memorable party favors for graduations, weddings, birthdays, and more. That's MMS.com. Use code HAPPIER to receive 15% off your next order. One of the other techniques you recommended in the book, you shorthanded as seeing or strengthening your vision or awareness. I think the specific exercise is returning to your zero point. What does that mean?
Zero point is fundamental awareness. So, you know, I was inspired long time ago by a poem from William Blake. He said, "We are led to believe a lie when we see with and not through the eye that was born in a night to perish in a night while the soul slept in beams of light." So normally when you look at certain people or anything, you look at it with the conditioned mind. Now, when you see from the zero point, there is no preconditioned labeling to seeing. Now, a thing I do for fun is in New York City, because it's a nice city to walk, I look at people And I can see them from birth to death, fertilized egg, embryo, zygote, baby, toddler, teenager, young adult, old adult, all the way to dusty death. And then I realize there's no such thing as a body. It's just a verb for an activity in consciousness. You know, this is seeing. It is not perceiving, but seeing, a deeper level of seeing.
I love that exercise.
Yeah.
And I like the idea of body as a verb because we get so attached and then do so much suffering around our own bodies.
Yeah. And when in fact, your awareness, if you go to like just the bottom of the ocean is free of the turbulence of the waves on the ocean, like that, the zero point is free of all these experiences that we get caught up in, you know, and that's a very Buddhist thing that you get caught up in because you hold on and say, if you hold on to your breath, you'll suffocate. Hold on to anything, you'll suffocate. And we hold on to nouns when in fact they're all verbs.
Yes. Yes. Well said. One of the other phrases you use in the book is I, the letter I, is a bad habit. What do you mean by that?
See, I am Deepak is a provisional identity. I am Dan Harris is a provisional identity. But as all the, even in the biblical traditions, I am that I am. So I am is our common identity. When I stop identifying with the ego body mind and go back to the real I, the big I, then I'm free of the judgments that are in the skin encapsulated ego body mind. So that is what I meant was I is a bad habit, meaning the localized I, not the non-localized.
Can you break that down? Because I get a little confused at what's the difference between the localized I and the non-local I?
The localized is the conditioned mind. So as soon as you're born, you're given a name, you're given an ethnicity, you're given a religion, you're given a national identity, you're given an economic identity, a racial identity. Now you're screwed for the rest of your life. You go to war for that, you know, what's happening in Gaza or anywhere else. But there is a deeper I, which is a common human identity, which is non-local. It is awareness. So ultimately, awareness is the only real absolute identity. Every other identity is provisional, whether it's racial or ethnic or religious or economic.
Let me see if I can say a few words that, and you tell me if I'm in the right neighborhood here. Mm-hmm. In Buddhism, we talk a lot about ultimate reality and relative reality.
Correct.
On the relative level, on a conventional level, you're Deepak, I'm Dan. And we all have to put our pants on and we have driver's licenses with our names on them, et cetera. But on the ultimate level, if I look for Dan in my mind, I can't find him.
You won't find him. Yeah.
Yes.
Correct.
And so that is, I think, what you're pointing to here.
That is exactly. And now with psychedelics, you know, all the research on psychedelics, our foundation is very involved in psychedelic research, particularly also for not only chronic illness, but fear of death, you know, terminal end of life care. So what psychedelics do is they reduce the activity of a part of the brain called the default mode network. Mm. Now, it turns out the default mode network is the neural correlate of the ego mind. And when that dissolves, they have this feeling of expansiveness and they even lose their fear of death. So that is a very interesting thing that actually corresponds to what you just said. You know, no local identity. There's only one awareness.
So the reason why, one of the reasons why I can be a bad habit is it makes you scared of the day when I no longer exists.
That's it. But you never existed in the first place.
Right. There's a expression sometimes that I've heard from meditation teachers that, you know, there's a scary moment that can happen in meditation and in psychedelics where the ego dissolves, at least at the beginning, that can be scary. And the analogy that's sometimes used is like, it's like jumping out of an airplane. And at some point you realize, I don't have a parachute, and that's terrifying. And then you realize there's no ground. And that's the freeing moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you afraid of death?
No, I mean, I now have so reconciled, but I also know that trillions of people have come before me and died. Why would I be the exception? The only thing I think we should aim for is a healthy death, you know, which in, again, these wisdom traditions is you finally say, been there, done that, you close your eyes and you take the big meditation. That's what the Buddha was supposed to have done. His last words were, this lifetime of ours is transient as autumn clouds. To watch the birth and death of beings is like looking at a movement of a dance. A lifetime is like a flash of lightning in the sky, rushing by like a torrent down a steep mountain. So when he said these words, or supposed to have said these, Ananda said, so who are you? Are you a prophet? Are you a messiah? And he said, none of the above. He said, who are you? He said, I'm awake. That was his last words. He woke up from the dream that we call everyday reality. And it is a dream. You know, Wittgenstein said the same thing. We are asleep, our life is a dream. Once in a while, we wake up enough to know that we're dreaming. By the time you hear these words, they don't exist. If I asked you what happened to your childhood, you'd say, it's a dream. But what about yesterday? It's a dream. Actually, if I try to look at yesterday or even this morning, it's as ephemeral as last night's dream. The whole thing is a dream.
Would you call yourself awake or enlightened?
I don't know what enlightenment means, but I do call myself, I don't say it aloud, but I feel awake because I walk around New York City and see people take their existence for granted. They're not even surprised. I mean, they're like biological robots. And I don't want to live that kind of life, at least at my stage. I would say I'm awake, yeah. I'm surprised by existence.
Surprised by existence. So that's one definition of being awake.
Yeah. Surprised by, bewildered. You know, Rumi said, exchange your cleverness for bewilderment.
Yes, that seems like a very healthy thing to put out into the culture right now, where cleverness and certainty are valued more than bewilderment.
Yeah. Yeah, listen, I spent all my life defending my point of view, and then I realized it's just another point of view.
What's your relationship to ambition right now? I mean, you keep writing books and putting things out into the world.
I write books because, again, you know, when I said I'm neurotic, I meant it. I'm a compulsive, obsessive neurotic who's always thinking about these things. And then I feel compelled to write about them. But, you know, I don't look as I used to in the past. I used to check the bestseller list and all that. I don't do that anymore.
But, and I was Googling you recently. You've done some deals with like a cruise line to bring wellness on board.
So what I did was I sold the company. And so I don't actually have a business anymore. And part of the contract was when the cruise ship stops in New York, I'll go give a lecture.
I see. So it might look on one level like you've got a lot going on, but actually it's a little calmer than it looks.
Yeah. My work now is on the foundation, the nonprofit we have. So peace efforts, longevity experiments, leadership training, things. I do a course called The Soul of Leadership. And, you know, the Obama Foundation invited me to do a course for their Obama leaders, etc. More of that now. No business. Business seems there, but I've sold it. I don't have a company anymore.
What's the biggest challenge for you in your practice in life right now?
Getting to detach so much that I want to detach and I won't be allowed to by my family. You know, even if you want to detach from your family, they won't let you. So, you know, it's a big challenge, but internally I'm detaching. You know, we have to detach ultimately from this body and this life experience. So you might as well prepare for it.
The balance is between letting go of this body, of this life, of accumulation, et cetera, while remaining engaged with the loved ones.
Yeah, it is do what you need to do, but don't worry about the outcome. It's a very traditionally yogic practice that, you know, they say karma yoga is do what needs to be done and forget about the outcome. So I do my best.
This has been really fun to catch back up with you. Is there anything that you wish I would have asked, but, you know, anything that you...
No, I mean, you asked all the right questions.
Deepak Chopra, thank you very much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. It was a privilege to catch up again.
Thanks again to Deepak Chopra for coming on. A reminder, his new book is called Quantum Body. I should say this is episode 2 of our 10th anniversary series, celebrating 10 years since I put out my first book, 10% Happier. Make sure to go check out the kickoff episode where I talk to my producers, DJ Kashmir and Lauren Smith, about how the book changed my life and the many things I learned during the course of writing it and subsequently. We'll put a link to that episode in the show notes. And we'll also drop a link to buy the revised 10th anniversary edition of the book. It's got a new preface in which I reflect on what has changed and what I've learned over the past 10 years, and a new appendix with some meditation instructions. 10% Happier is produced by Lauren Smith, Gabrielle Zuckerman, Justine Davey, and Tara Anderson. DJ Kashmir is our senior producer. Marissa Schneiderman is our senior editor. Kevin O'Connell is our director of audio and post-production. And Kimmy Regler is our executive producer. Alicia Mackey leads our marketing. And Tony Magyar is our director of podcasts. Nick Thorburn of Islands wrote our theme. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than 2 centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the new Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.